Welcome to The Lisa Show, where we take a good look at life. Hey, it's Lisa. Before we start, I just want to let you know, in case you're listening to this where children can hear, that this episode of The Lisa Show includes information that's not age appropriate for all kids. It's my hope that listening to this will spark critically important conversations that every parent needs to have with their kids. We're going to get into that in depth next episode. But you may want to screen this one before sharing it so you can tailor your approach to your family. And one more thing, because this is a tender topic, you should also know that we're talking about betrayal trauma and infidelity. You know, sometimes people will ask me what The Lisa Show is, and I have to explain it in like 10 seconds or less. And I like to say that my favorite part is having conversations about stuff that people should talk about more. Like, what are we, society, not talking about, but should be? Today's topic is one of those things. It's big. And the last time we covered it, and not even very much, it just came up in a conversation, we received a flood of private messages from you, from our listener community, from people saying, "This is my life. I feel so alone. What do I do?" So while I already considered it an important topic, having that little glimpse into how personal and tender it is for so many of us makes me feel especially relieved that we're finally getting to tackle it head on. How do you heal from sexual addiction or compulsive sexual behavior, whether it's you personally or someone you love? What do you do when you find out that your partner is struggling, or your child, or your friend? How much help is there really for someone who loses control? Our guest today, Stephen Shields, has seen literally thousands of people through their journey of recovery and healing, and he's adamant that there is hope for everyone. People heal. They recover. He actually gave us so much that I'm splitting this conversation into two parts because I want to do it justice. In this episode, part one, you're going to hear Stephen's story and seven critically important things to know about healing and recovery, including how to start today. Next episode, we'll get into how to start important conversations at home, particularly with kids. But before I get too ahead of myself, let me tell you that Stephen Shields is a mental health counselor, an addiction recovery coach, a speaker, and the founder of Unashamed Unafraid, a nonprofit organization and podcast which provides hope and resources to individuals in recovery for sex addiction and their families. And as a side note, you'll hear us reference God and church because that's the framework that Stephen and I share, but you don't have to subscribe to that. Actually, you'll hear in this episode about someone whose higher power in recovery was nature. Stephen's approach is universal. And as a bonus, he's also just fun to talk to, the kind of person you can sit down with for the first time and feel like you've known for years. Who are you? What do you do?
Well, so I think those are two different questions.
Okay, maybe not the who are you.
No, whatever. Well, I am what I would say is I'm someone who really believes in the hope of the gospel. And my journey is one of sexual addiction recovery. And that's a really broad term that a lot of things can fit under, which we can talk about that. But I was someone who really needed a hospital and was super broken. And then through some cool experiences in my life and the gospel, you know, was able to find out that there was a hospital. That turns out healing is real. Turns out Jesus is the Christ, who knew? And so in discovering that, like many people, I'm like, does everyone know there's a hospital out here?
Right.
Because this—
Does anybody else need help?
Yeah, because like you want to kill a dinner party conversation, be like, oh yeah, I had a sexual addiction. Like, woof, we're out, right? Like that is the end of that conversation.
People pretend like they don't hear what you just said.
Yeah, and there's this experience that people have, like I talk about it. It's kind of like you put on like the orange jumpsuit, like you're a convict now. Like you're othered. There's a lot of shame that comes with this. And particularly like I have a pretty big story. And so I was like, there's a way to get this jumpsuit off. Like there's healing that happens. And so I kind of got in the waiting room and helping people because I had this experience with God at a men's retreat, just a vow of silence, just in prayer with God. And I'm like, why is my story so big? Because I'm like in the bishopric, stealing money from the family business, hiring prostitutes while looking at a bunch of porn. So that's me 11 years ago.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, why couldn't I have just been like a porn guy? Like what? Like this is big. Like there's a lot of collateral damage. There's a lot of stuff. Like what's the story? And so I get this from God. I listen to a lot of Christian hip hop music. Some lyrics from a song about Tell the World. And it keeps coming to my mind. And the inspiration came to put together a podcast because people don't really speak from this space. So you can find like the therapist people talking about it or like church people way on the other end from a distance talking about it. But no one's like, I'm that guy.
Yeah, let me tell you about my experience.
Right. And so that's how Unashamed Unafraid got started. And so it's a quote from a Christian rap song, Lecrae Moore, Grammy-winning artist. It says, there's plenty of people like me, all outsiders like me, all unashamed and all unafraid to live out who they're supposed to be. And so I realized part of my healing was not being ashamed. Like, we all have sin. We all fall short. We all talk about that until it's our actual sin and we're actually falling short. Then it's a lot harder to talk about. And so started recording stories of people in recovery to let people know there's a hospital. And so fast forward, we're a nonprofit now and we do scholarships to different resources we've known work and have a bunch of different stories and experts on the show and different things. So I'm just someone who actually believes people heal.
You can probably already tell the impact Stephen is making. His wife, Kayla, often joins him in talking about this and sharing their experience. She wasn't with us in the studio today, but I'm dying to meet her. But in the meantime, I asked Stephen to recap his journey for me because we've heard a little bit of it, but he's going to reference it again later, and it's pretty incredible.
So my story, I was first exposed to porn. It's a pretty common story, so sadly. I was first exposed to porn when I was 11. So before 2007, you could just spam people with porn. Right. And so I had the experience people have, freaked out, you know, didn't, but I liked it because I was aroused, but it's bad, you know, struggled with a lot of porn, sexual behavior in high school, you know, was raised a Latter-day Saint and in the church. So I kind of did like a three-quarter repentance when I went on my mission, like named the stuff, but didn't like quite name that I had sex with someone, didn't quite name that part. But when I got home, you know, I was really committed with a friend of mine. Like, we're never going to look at porn again. We're going to do the thing. And at that point in time, I didn't realize that the try harder gospel didn't work. And so the shame just buried me. And so that escalated. High to my addiction was bishopric in my ward, stealing money from the family business, facilitating prostitution, watching a bunch of porn, like porn every day. Then I had this moment when Kayla was out of town. I'm acting out and God just hits me like this grace moment of like, I'm going to be down the road in my life. And when it can hurt the most people, that's when Satan's going to expose me. And so I have this dual life. Like I really did believe in Jesus, but I have this huge dual life. And so I was like, well, I'm probably getting divorced, getting excommunicated from my church and my whole life's burning down anyways. So it's either going to burn down now where I hurt less people, or it's going to burn down later when I hurt everyone. So I'd love to tell you that I was like so faithful and it was my love for Jesus that brought me into recovery. I just had too much shame and I was too numbed out to be there. And so that's how my recovery started. I came forward, I told Kayla. And then, you know, over time it was two more big relapses in that process before, you know, the atonement really worked. Like I finally really trusted the process with God to let him heal me instead of me try and heal myself and try harder and do it. And so a lot of different hospital moments in that story for me, from therapy to men's retreats to some amazing people in church that really showed up for me. That's the story in a nutshell of, you know, how I got here and started Unashamed and Afraid.
There's two things Stephen introduced here that I want to highlight, both critically important things to know about healing. First, you've probably heard him talk about the try harder method or try harder gospel, a misconception that a lot of people have who are dealing with compulsive sexual behavior, either personally or as a spouse or as a parent. It's this idea that healing or changing is as simple as just deciding to try harder without necessarily taking the proven steps to recover. And it's wrong, and that's what you need to know. The try harder gospel is a fallacy that actually keeps people from recovering. Stephen's going to break that down more before the end of the episode. The other thing Stephen introduced here is related to how he uses the word hospital. This is a metaphor for an essential part of healing that everybody needs, but which can really vary in what it looks like from one person to the next.
When we talk about the hospital, people find different things. So I'd say any type of therapy, any type of 12-step group, it got put together for us to do the thing. And church is the same way. And so that hospital can mean different things. I know people have had amazing healing journeys who have never set foot in a church. I know people have amazing healing journeys who have never set foot in therapy ever. I know people have amazing healing journeys that therapy was the thing. And they would say, I can name the therapist that saved my life. I know people who will tell you their church community was the community that saved them. And when building community, finding that hospital, just like anything, right? Like, look it up, man. Get the Google reviews. Someone's like, well, I don't know that I want to go to church. I'm like, why don't you just try going to some church and see if it works? Well, I don't know if I want to go to therapy. Have a first appointment with two or three therapists. See if it works. And so that hospital can be any of those things that can really help. And what I would say is anything where really you can find community and God. The number one indicator of whether someone will recover or not by a mile is how strong their community is.
This is the second bit of critical knowledge everyone needs to know about recovery, that you need a hospital community, that there is one for everybody. In other words, people don't heal alone, but you don't have to go far to find the people who will help you. Like Stephen said, it could be church, or it could be therapy, or something else entirely. For healing to occur, you absolutely need one, but you've got options. So that's what he means when he says hospital. That being said, not every community is automatically a hospital. And this can be especially true in worship communities, where people tend to be squeamish about topics like sexual addiction and compulsive behavior. Stephen often visits churches to help start the conversation, and he remembered an experience with one minister who was confident that no one in the congregation actually needed the message.
I get why people don't talk about it. Because it's hard, but it's easier sometimes to just pretend it's not there, right? And like not have the issues. And I was doing a fireside in a ward once, and I talked to the bishop before, and he was like, yeah, I mean, this is great, but I don't think anyone in my ward like is having an affair or has been, like, I'm sure there's some people who maybe struggle with some porn. And I had done this before, and I said, look, Bishop, so here's what's going to happen. We're going to do the thing. I'm going to share the story. I'm going to have you stand up at the end and say, hey, are you really going to be safe? And you're really going to hold people in kindness and in a Christ-like way? And then what's going to happen is they're going to show up in your office. And then when you don't know what to do, feel free to shoot me an email. But, you know, we can do that. So about a month later, I get the email. He's like, turns out there's some stuff going on, but we don't have... like, we just don't have a great story for people who are struggling of, like, a place for them to be. And we do this in different populations in our congregation and within our families. Like, it's tough to be the one that has the problem.
I want you to remember this story that Stephen is mentioning, how we don't necessarily have a narrative for people who are struggling with this, and how that makes it harder for individuals and their families to get the help they need. Creating space in our community for this topic, for vulnerable conversations, is vitally important. And Stephen's going to explain how we do that, starting with the third critical thing to know. Focusing on how bad the behavior is doesn't help. It actually does the opposite.
One of the things that people don't realize is most helpful. Like, you don't have to tell someone who's struggling with some compulsive sexual behavior that, like, they're in trouble or they're doing something really dark or really bad. I sit with these friends all the time. I promise you they know. They're feeling really bad about it, right? And so just right-sizing it to give people the capacity to talk about it.
Don't invoke fire and brimstone, whether it's yourself or someone else. It's not your job, and it doesn't help. Rehashing how bad something is doesn't prevent the behavior. It just doubles down on the impression that this isn't a good hospital, that you're not safe to share authentically here. Instead, do right-size the issue. Right-sizing can be hard, especially because this is tender, and a lot of the language that gets used around compulsive sexual behavior adds unnecessary fear, labels, and limiting beliefs to the conversation.
So just because your teenage kid has looked at porn 5 or 6 times doesn't mean they're a porn addict, doesn't mean it's going to be their whole life, right?
Yeah, and I'm glad that you brought that up because I know that some say, especially in a conservative Christian environment, we're kind of overdiagnosing or overreacting, and not everyone who has this behavior XYZ is necessarily an addict. What is your response to that kind of debate?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things. So one, the label in the middle, like I would never call anyone an addict. That's the first, like if anyone were taking these from the show, I'd be like, don't call people addicts. Because—
Ever.
Ever. Because addiction is a process that I'm going through and something I have, right? So like, I wouldn't call you COVID if you have COVID. Or if you had cancer, I wouldn't be like, oh, Lisa, you mean the cancer one? Oh yeah, we were over at cancer's house, like— How's that feel, right? No one wants, it's something someone's going through. So is addiction real? Yes, it's just the process of a compulsive behavior happening on repeat. So is addiction real? Yes. Is anyone an addict? No. So I'd say I, Stephen Shields, have never been an addict. I, Stephen Shields, have really struggled with addiction for sure. And so that pathologizing, to use the therapy words, is like the first place to go. Like someone can't be an addict. So when your teenage kid is walking in and they're like, I've been looking at a bunch of porn and I read on the internet I'm probably an addict and I saw the billboard for therapy and I think I'm in trouble and I'm never going to serve a mission and not go to college and be the black sheep of the family. I'd first be like, you can't be anything other than what God made you to be. So that label can't be true. And so the first is like, don't pathologize it. Don't label someone something that, in my opinion, they actually can't be.
This is the fourth thing. Don't pathologize addiction and don't put labels on yourself or others. As Stephen explained, there are several reasons why this matters so much. And it goes back to what he was saying about stories. If you don't have a narrative for how someone overcomes addiction and all you have instead are labels and shame, your definition of the experience could be getting in the way of recovery. The struggle doesn't deserve to define the person, especially when people recover all the time.
Anyone can do it. So I can tell you crazy stories. People who were acting out. I recently had a story of a man, his background faith is Catholic, down in the state of Texas, so Southern guy, and he's hiring multiple prostitutes a week. This is going for 20 years. Goes into his recovery process 9 months later. 9 months, I'm having a conversation with him, and in his southern drawl, he's like, Shields, you know when, like, you've got a fever? And I'm like, yeah, I don't know where this is going, but okay. And he's like, you know, like, you got a fever, and then finally, like, you have that cold sweat, and, like, it breaks, and your fever breaks, and then you're just better. Like, you just feel better. Head, tummy all the way down, and I'm like, sure, man, yeah. He's like, it broke. Like it broke. Like I'm there. So just like Christ healing the blind man, raising Lazarus from the dead, like it can break.
Getting to that moment where the fever breaks is where a hospital becomes so important. Because as Stephen will tell you, healing isn't automatic. And even though a community is essential, just having a community isn't what causes a person to heal. Critical knowledge number 5 is that you need someone to share with. It's being able to process this experience in a fully honest, authentic way with another human being that turns a community into a cure.
It's not a function of time. That's one thing I tell you. Healing's not a function of time. It's a function of doing the things. And what I can tell you is a couple of the key things that people have that I'd say really recover, get to recover, right? That the hope is there is, one, they share their story. And that doesn't mean that you have to come on a podcast with Lisa and talk all about your personal
right.
life and do the thing. But when
it's
no one,
one
knows
way.
You, it's a way.
It's a way,
you know. So send her an email. I think she's having future guests. But so it's sharing your story, as Brené Brown says, with those who are worthy to hear it. And so my story is known. Right, like people know me and accept me because like I can tell you I'm leaving this studio and I'm going to play pickleball with my sweet wife, Kayla. And what I know is I'm not going to be standing out there, right, when she's like, hey, I just love being here with you playing pickleball or and we have fun tonight. I'm not going to be in any of those intimate experiences with her emotionally, spiritually, physically, or otherwise and have the question, yeah, but if she really knew my story, she wouldn't be choosing me. She wouldn't be choosing this. And so your story has to be known. You can't do it alone. It never works. That's the try harder gospel. There are millions of prayers, Lisa, they're going to get prayed tonight that are sincere, that are incredibly sincere. And it breaks my heart, right? Of Heavenly Father, please stop me from looking at the porn. Please help me stop this behavior. Please help me change. Please help me just try harder and do it. But when we start to share with others and we realize we're not alone, right, we can start asking the hope questions. God, is it possible? Is hope possible? So I hope no one listens to this podcast and hits their knees and says, God, change my behavior. I hope they hit their knees and say, God, I want to know if Lisa and that guy Stephen on there, if that's real. Is it real? Is it possible for me to really get past this? Or are those guys just full of it? Because that prayer gets answered every time. And when we start to share our story and we get heard, that's when all of the things we need start coming together.
Oh, I love that. It's interesting when I hear you speak about overcoming addiction, living with it, and sharing your story, about how similar that is with my experience with grief, of being able to hold on to that. Like, it's mirrored almost exactly. It's so interesting, something that you can't do on your own, that you have absolutely no ability to.
Yeah, and spoiler alert, it's actually true with all of our wounds. So,
I know.
So that's what yeah, it's like what happens, like people are like, yeah, what do you do if you're looking? I'm like, the same thing you do with all the other healing, the same thing with the different struggles that happen, because there is grief there. Do I have grief around the tons of pain that I caused Kayla and others in my life? Of course. So no experience is in this, including anyone struggling, right? And then there's the whole camp of everyone who's family and partners of people struggling. To find out that your husband or wife has been having an ongoing affair or an ongoing addiction is literally life-shattering. The symptoms of that trauma are very similar to PTSD symptoms of people coming back from war in Iraq and from being raped and, you know, physical abuse as a child. And so it's not just the person who's struggling, like people in relationship with that person. There's a lot of deception and difficulty that happens.
I thought it was so telling that being the spouse of someone struggling with compulsive sexual behavior was, like Stephen said, so similar to other life-altering traumas. This is not a small thing. It affects your brain. And so, of course, I had to ask him what someone can expect from this journey. What does it look like to be a spouse? And where does healing start in that scenario?
First, you're going to feel all the things, right? It's the same thing of allowing healing to happen. So community is still the number one indicator, because if you go, I'm not going to tell anyone that my partner had an affair, and I'm just going to pretend everything's okay, and I'm going to go to church, which is supposed to be a hospital, not a country club, but I'm going to treat it like a country club because I want to keep our status in the club and our social connections, as opposed to treating it like the hospital that God designed it to be. And I'm not going to tell anyone about it. And so it's that same community factor, because both parties have a level of victimhood. You didn't choose. It's not your fault that your partner's acting out. It's not your fault. Their behavior's a choice, right? So you have to not minimize that experience. There's a grief there that your life got blown up. It's super disorienting. So that's why when people experience the term they use clinically is betrayal trauma. Because if you and I are walking down a dark alley in New York City, and we're by ourselves and we're like, I don't know, rough neighborhood, but looks like a shortcut, you know? And we walk through that alley and someone mugs us and takes our wallet. We at least have a narrative for that trauma making sense, right? Because we're like, dark alley, big city, late at night.
Scary.
Okay. Scary. That all makes sense, right?
Yep.
We don't have a narrative for the person who we got married to in our white dress, the person who we got married to in our church, right? Who says, no matter what, I'm going to be there for you. I'm in love with you. I'm your number one. We don't have a narrative of them mugging us in the alley. And so it's so disorienting. And that's why community is so important, because it helps you get oriented back, right? So if I like can't tell the weather outside, I can ask our friends over here in the booth and you'd be like, wait, what temperature is it outside? And because y'all are trustworthy, right? And we're now all best friends, I can be like, hey, you know, how's this gonna work? And get oriented around that, right? Where when I'm by myself and my partner's like, hey, wait, were you just texting the other woman again? No, you're crazy. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't have a way to orient around that if I don't do without community.
Well, and also in grief and trauma, your brain tries to protect you.
For sure.
And you can make up stories and, yeah, a lot of the traumatic brain injury symptoms, you know, that follow grief and trauma.
Yep. Yeah, super disorienting.
Yeah.
And that's like why the 12 steps has been so successful, is because when I can go sit in a room and be like, hi, my name's Steven, I struggle looking at porn, and I'm in a room with 10 other men who know that, or go to a therapy group or retreat or whatever, then I start to be like, oh, I don't think I'm the orange jumpsuit convict that can ever make it back, because I'm with all these other people that have made it back.
Whether you were dealing with an addiction personally or the grief and betrayal on the receiving end as a spouse, community is number one. You cannot keep it to yourself if you want to heal. And like Steven mentioned, struggling with compulsive behavior is often accompanied by deceptive behavior to cover it up. Gaslighting, lying, hiding things. Having an outside support to lean on, someone you can trust who can keep you oriented, is critical to your mental health and well-being. And a lot of people struggle with this one. Letting someone in, spilling what feels like a deep, dark secret, is a big leap of faith. And I had to ask Steven about that. You know, not everyone, obviously, is as comfortable talking about everything like you are, or with their own recovery. They may be listening and thinking, yeah, that's nice, good for you, but yeah, I'm not ready to do it.
Yep.
It would have too much collateral damage.
Mm-hmm.
And the risk doesn't outweigh like even that hopeful benefit. What advice do you have for people or loved ones who are in that situation right now?
You start with one person. And this is where, again, you want to talk about prayers that God answers. Dear Heavenly Father, I just listened to the Lisa Show like I do every week because it's a very good decision, and you've already confirmed that to me. And so gratitude for that. And are they full of crap or is hope real? They said that I need to have community, and I think I would die if I told anyone what's really going on with me right now, where this goes wrong. So dear God, give me a path to do this where I don't tell anyone, but I get healed and then I'm finally worthy of you, and then you and I can talk about it more. Doesn't get answered. God, show me, lead me, inspire me to one person who could hold my story. Help me find one person who I could talk to about that I just found out that my husband is looking at a bunch of porn, or I just found out about my teenage kid, or I'm the teenage kid. God, I don't think it's the parents. The church leaders freak me out. Just help me find one friend that I can level with to start to navigate this, right? Or if I'm not ready to tell my spouse, I'm not ready to tell my spouse that I'm cheating on her, I'm doing all this crazy stuff and whatever, or that I'm looking at a bunch of porn, that's just gonna blow up my whole life. Just help me find one person, one good friend. And that can be a coworker, that can be someone at church, that can be someone in your friends group, your bowling club, your roller rink, I don't care, right? But that is a prayer I will tell you God will answer every time.
Find one person and call on your higher power to help you find that person and give you the courage to share. This is the sixth critical thing to know about healing and recovery. It requires a higher power. Steven pointed out that this higher power doesn't even have to be God.
I remember I was working with this lady, and she just needed the grace, right, of like, I'm enough. And I remember I asked her, I said, what's a higher power to you, something larger than yourself? And she said, the ocean. I really connect with the ocean. So I did this experience exercise, bring the ocean in the room. I said, if the ocean could talk to you about all these mistakes you've made and your brokenness, what would it tell you? And Lisa, it was the weirdest thing. Do you know what the ocean said to her? The exact thing Jesus would say. So by any other name. And so what I've learned is to meet people where they're at and just say, you know, what do you see is larger than yourself? So the default I tell people is to go to nature. Nature's one of the biggest places that I see people find their spirituality, their higher power, who aren't God quotation marks people. But I've never seen people work great recovery or get to recovered or have real healing that aren't anchored in a higher power. I know some non-church people that are really, really anchored in nature, in the ocean.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so meet people where they're at.
Everyone needs to be anchored to something larger than themselves so they can feel that transformative grace and ask for hope for just enough light to take the next step of finding a person to talk to. Nobody has to do this alone, and nobody can. Stephen pointed out to me that this relationship to a higher power is also what makes a person resilient as they're navigating their resources and finding the right community. People who are trying to be supportive aren't always going to say the right things, whether that's family, friends, church leaders, even professionals like therapists. Being vulnerable may not pay off immediately. And when you're taking those first few steps, a higher power acts as a compass so that you can overcome setbacks and find people who are worthy of your trust.
I promise you, God is going to lead you. You've got the right compass. You're the right head coach for the job. I think one of the most gaslit things people get told is to trust the process. Just don't worry about it. You just trust what's happening to you. What to tell yourself is, instead of I'm going to trust the process of my recovery or I'm going to trust the process of my healing from betrayal trauma, what I'm going to tell you is God doesn't make junk and he didn't screw up when he made you. So what you need to change that mantra to is trust my process. Trust your process. When you go to that therapist office and that first session feels like a waste of time, when you go sit in with that church leader or that friend and they're not safe, believe yourself. Move on and find someone else in your community. You use your compass, your connection to your higher power, and trust your process.
As you trust your process, you may also find that breaking the silence around sexual addiction and compulsive behavior has a positive ripple effect even beyond yourself. It doesn't just provide that essential community for healing. It can also be the catalyst for someone else beginning their healing journey. Stephen is quick to credit the people whose honest stories about recovery gave him hope that he could do it too, and the friends who checked in on him and were able to provide ongoing support and accountability. You heard us talking just a little bit about grace earlier. This is the seventh final thing to know. Grace empowers recovery. In the same way Stephen is doing now for others, the people in his community channeled grace until he felt it from the source.
As I created my own community of brotherhood, I had, you know, later in the story, my last, you know, big relapse, I had already started Unashamed and Afraid. I'd been through my first church discipline process. I'd been through the therapy. Lisa, I'd done all the things. And so I remember sitting outside this therapy office. It's the first time I said to Kayla, I was like, Kayla, maybe I just am a bad person who's trying to do good things and prove that I'm good. Like, maybe it's not the other way around. You know, that I'm a good person who's doing bad. I'm like, maybe I'm just a bad person. And she'd tell you, she's like, I'd never seen him that dark. Because like, I get early on, people don't know what they know. Lisa, I know all the things. I'm carrying the banner. I'm the biggest hypocrite out of anyone in the world. You know, and I'm just like, man, I can't do this. And I had this experience with God where he just said to me, look, Stephen, you're never going to earn this. So try harder all you want. If you want to keep going out there and being the prodigal son, like, we can go back and forth as many times as you want to. My grace is sufficient. I can and will heal you whenever you're ready. But if you want to go do this for another three rounds and go act out again, like to prove whether or not I am who I say I am, feel free, because the story's not going to change. And after all the knowing I should have had and everything, like, that is where God just broke me. And just that grace, you can't unsee that, as they say. This just was the final changing in my heart.
I'm so grateful to Stephen for sharing not only his personal story, but his insights into the thousands of stories that he's witnessed as people heal from compulsive sexual behavior and addiction. Anyone can heal. But it starts by letting go of the mindset that you can just try harder to get over it. Whether your struggle is the behavior or the pain you feel over someone else's, nobody does this alone. You need a hospital community, people you can share openly and honestly with about your experience and be connected to help and resources. I'm going to put some links in the show notes to a few good ones, but only you will know what's the best fit for your life. You don't have to dwell on how bad or wrong the behavior is. No one engaging in this conversation takes it lightly, and there's no need to rehash it. Instead, we can right-size it by avoiding personal labels like addict, even if there is an addiction. If you've listened to this and thought, I wish I had the strength, or I wish this were actually possible, or there's no one I could possibly share this with, it's too much, you're in the right place. Start by asking for that hope, asking for the guidance to one person, one resource, so that you can start honestly processing your experience and beginning to heal. And that's all you have to do right now. Shame will tell you that this is bigger than it is, and that there is no hope, and that you're alone, that this is some kind of stain that actually doesn't wash out. And the truth is the opposite of that. This is common. People recover all the time. You're not defined by your mistakes. The person you love isn't defined by their mistakes. And being honest opens the door for our communities to be less of a social club and more of the hospital they were always designed to be. Healing, empowering, infinite grace is real. And you don't have to earn it. You couldn't if you tried. It's just there. And whether you access it through a framework of God or Jesus or nature, your higher power can be the compass that guides you through your process. No matter who you are, there's hope.
The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio, hosted by Lisa Valentine Clark. This episode was produced by Becca Hurley, with help from Blake Morris, with post-production by Kip Merrill. For more information about our guest, Steve Shields, links to his work will be in our show notes. If you haven't subscribed to The Lisa Show on YouTube, you can find even more content on our channel, including the Council of Moms, filmed live in our studio. As always, thanks for your messages. We read them all, and thanks for listening.
Are you ready to immerse yourself in the awe-inspiring world of nature? Listen to Constant Wonder, another great show from the BYU Radio family of podcasts. Join host Marcus Smith in riveting conversations with individuals whose lives have been touched by the Earth's beauty and mysteries. Uncover captivating stories that shed light on our planet's wonders, from history to science and beyond. If you crave enriching experiences and deeper connections with the world around you, tune into Constant Wonder. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.